Anomaly. Something that deviates from what is standard,
normal,
or expected. An oddity, peculiarity, irregularity, inconsistency, incongruity, a rarity.
This is Jen and Angela from the Anomaly Podcast. We're doing a special re-release of the Anomaly Supplemental episode from August 2011, and they reviewed Labyrinth. We're releasing it again today in honor of the Goblin King, David Bowie. So who's on this one again?
Anne, Sue, and Casey.
That's right. Yeah. And see, it was a while back, but I know that a lot of people have been thinking about this lately, so I'm excited to put this back up in the feed.
Kind of celebrate his life.
Definitely. Yeah, I remember watching this movie when I was a kid and just being kind of enamored by the whole idea. I know that Sith Jen and I have always discussed going to Jareth's Ball. They have one in L.A. every year, mm-hmm. and where they do like a version. It's a big giant party where they kind of recreate the idea of the party in the movie. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And it's all about like super fantasy costumes and stuff like that. And just very high fashion, cool stuff. So the point is that Labyrinth and David Bowie, in general, all of that is still alive in everybody's imaginations, which is really cool.
We hope you enjoy it, and here it is.
We're either going to have to mark this explicit, or I'm going to have to cut out every instance of dream balls.
But we're not actually talking about balls. I mean, we're talking about actual balls, but not like...
Anomaly. Something that deviates from what is standard, normal, or expected. An oddity, peculiarity, irregularity, inconsistency, incongruity, a rarity.
I have been alert since long before I could have heard that bookish girl should look and act a certain way. And I'll still be a geek when I am utterly antique, because I do not care what normal people say.
Hi, I'm Anne.
I'm Casey.
I'm Sue. And welcome back to Anomaly Supplemental. This week, we are talking about Labyrinth, Jim Henson's Labyrinth from 1986, celebrating its 25th anniversary.
Yay! Happy birthday!
That makes me want to dance magic dance.
It really is its 25th anniversary because it opened in theaters on June 27th, 1986, which is almost exactly a week ago as of this recording, and will be almost a month ago as of the release date.
Wow.
So, since you've had 25 years to watch this movie, we're not really going to talk too much about the plot. Just a quick overview.
Frustrated with babysitting on yet another weekend night, Sarah, played by Jennifer Connelly, a teenager with an active imagination, summons the goblins to take her baby stepbrother away. When little Toby actually disappears, Sarah must follow him into a fantastical world to rescue him from the Goblin King, played by David Bowie. Guarding his castle is the Labyrinth itself, a twisted maze of deception populated with outrageous characters and unknown dangers. To get through it in time to save Toby, Sarah befriends the goblins in hopes that their loyalty isn't just another illusion in a place where nothing is as it seems.
The beginning of this movie terrifies me to this day. I'm pretty sure it's the reason I'm sure that there are goblins hiding under my bed at all times.
Even now.
Like, literally, if it's dark outside, I will, like, kind of do a little hop up onto the bed because the Goblin King's minions are living under my bed. As much as I love this movie, when I was a kid, I was terrified of this movie. What with all of them popping in and out of the cabinets, and when she does her whole, I wish you would take him away, right? Now, and then flips the switch off, and then everything post that is terrifying to me. And then I never understand how when David Bowie shows up as the Goblin King, how she's like, you're him. So are we supposed to believe that she's never seen him before? I think that's it. I just always think it's funny how she's just like, hello, I know exactly who you are and what this is. Scary dreams coming to life.
Yeah, it's like she's suddenly inside a fairy tale and is totally okay with it.
I just love that there's no commentary on it. And on top of there being no commentary, it's David Bowie. Like, come on. And he's an owl, and then he's a person. Who doesn't love that?
I love it.
What do you think of the CGI owl at the beginning?
It's not terrible, considering it was 1986. But today's standards, it's not Harry Potter owl.
Yeah, but it was, according to IMDb, it was the first attempt at CGI animal characters in a feature film. And for being the absolute first time that that happens in 1986...
Pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Although, do you think she realizes that Creepy Owl is watching you every single time she plays at that river in her costume? He, like, flies down after the CGI sequence and suddenly it's a real owl and he's just watching her? And I'm like, that's terrifying. Like, is that owl always there? I wonder.
It also reminds me of the Narnia books, because,
right.
I mean, they never really address the book that she has, The Labyrinth. Did someone previously have this happen to them and they wrote it all down?
Well, which brings me to another thing that I love, which is the sequence going through her room that's passing through the little merry-go-round music box and Where the Wild Things Are, which is clearly a Ludo reference, and you know, all the other things that sort of appear throughout the story. And then it very quickly passes over this picture of her mother in this Playbill ad, and it's clear that her mother was an actress, but you already know that she's a stepmother now, so you either assume that she's dead or just not there or is left.
The novelization of Labyrinth says that her mother divorced her father to live with her actor boyfriend named Jeremy, who, if you look at the picture on her mirror, it's David Bowie that she's sitting next
to. Wait, is it?
Yeah.
Oh my god, you're blowing my mind. That's not true, is it? Oh my god.
There are whole new levels to this movie, baby.
Well, the thing about this movie, and I don't know if it's true for you, is that I identify with it even more now. As a kid, there was something just intrinsically captivating about it. And now I realize, and maybe I'm a crazy person, but I used to feel like that. And granted, I was an only child, but I did a lot of playing by myself and make-believe. And, you know, I have a whole, like, journal at my house. I used to, like, write them down of, like, all these adventures that I had with, like, imaginary friends and, like, going, you know, on these adventures and everything. And I just think it's so interesting that this is a story at the heart of it. It's kind of like a coming-of-age tale about what happens when you have to come to grips with the fact that you might be a little too old to have these things in your life, and if they're growing with you, they're also growing in power, and they're becoming a little dangerous. You give it power by believing in it over and over again, and you almost want it to happen, but then when it does, it's actually horrifying, which is one of the things that fascinates me about the character of the Goblin King.
I definitely related to Sarah when I was a teenager. I don't relate to her anymore because I'm older and I'm just like, oh, stop whining. I had siblings. I was the middle child, so I was both the younger and the older sibling at the same time. I'm the weird paradox. You know, I was also a theater kid. I was off playing by myself, reading lines and pretending I was a Disney princess. And then I would come home and I would be told to do chores. And I was like, that's not fair.
And that's Sarah's catchphrase throughout a good 75% of the movie. Just every time something happens, she goes, that's not fair. And she's finally confronted with it when David Bowie, when Jareth says to her, you keep saying that. I wonder what your basis for comparison is.
Yeah.
And at that point that she pretty much stops saying that. It's like, oh, right. I don't have anything to compare this to. And sometimes, like when she falls into the oubliette after choosing the correct door in the logic puzzle, sometimes you make the absolutely correct decision in life, but you still end up in a crappy situation.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really great observation. And I also love how it then becomes this very empowering thing when she says, "You have no power over me," which even though it's unsaid until the end of the film, you know, when she says, when she's about to go in and try and save Toby, when they reach the Goblin City and they get to the center, she says, "This is something I have to do alone." And she goes and she, you know, finishes it herself. And I think it's really funny that she goes from being this victim and whiny to going in and trying to, like, save someone's life who, you know, she damned in a way. I mean, maybe that's too over the top for Labyrinth, but I just love that aspect of it.
No, I think it's perfect because you watch sci-fi and fantasy movies and you don't come across a lot of female characters who are empowering. And the fact that this girl who allowed herself to be the victim at the very beginning of the movie basically becomes the hero at the very end and tells a man, "You have no power over me," there's a big impact that comes with that.
Look what I'm offering you. Your dreams.
And my kingdom is great.
I ask for so little. Just let me rule you, and you can have everything that you want.
Kingdom is great. Damn, I can never remember that line.
Just fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your slave.
No power over me.
You know, you don't get a lot of that anymore. Not even in regular movies either.
I also like the idea that when she says, "You have no power over me," she's saying it to not only to a man, but to something that she has given power herself. So yeah. It's a very self-empowering moment to realize that you have to grow up a little bit and give these things up. But then I love at the end how she's back at home and, you know, CGI owl flies out of the stairwell area, and she goes up to her room and she's looking in the mirror, and then all of her little friends are saying, you know, "Great job, but if ever you should need us..."
Goodbye, Sarah.
And remember, fair maiden, should you need us...
Yes, should you need us, for any reason at all.
I need you, Hoggle.
You do?
I don't know why, but every now and again in my life, for no reason at all, I need you, all of you.
It's this message where it's okay to have these things in your life, but there's a life to live and you can't just give in to them, but isn't it fun that they're there?
Yes, completely. I actually just watched a TED conference video with the playwright and activist Eve Ensler, she talked about the importance of girlhood, and we place so much emphasis on being a woman and not being a girl. And she does grow up by saying, "You have no power over me," but then she can, you know, every now and then go back and play with her friends, be a kid again. I think that's very important.
You know, I think I noticed, but I didn't fully realize until I was taking notes this last pass on Labyrinth, the part where Hoggle gives her the peach and she eats the peach, and it's this very, I know it's a peach, but it's a very Eve moment where then she gets whisked away into this fantasy world where it's very adult and she's coming to grips with what it actually is to love the Goblin King, or more importantly, to be loved by, in a stalkery way, the Goblin King. It's, again, I think more than she bargained for in a way. And there's a very Peter Pan thing going on for the Goblin King, where if he loves her the way an adult would love another adult, then she's no longer a child, which is what he loves about her.
It's true. When you're young and, like, just hitting puberty as a girl, what you're supposed to dream about, I guess, anyway, is meeting your Prince Charming and falling in love. And then at that age, I think she's supposed to be 14 or 15, in the movie, being faced with that reality of love or of deciding your future, you can be shocked. I think that's what happens to Sarah. She's faced with this idea of this is what love really means and this is what a relationship really means if this is what you're looking for.
Right.
And it's something completely different than what we're led to believe.
And I also think it's really cool that they make it very important that she's a teenager character and she is thinking about love and the whole hormone thing coming into effect and the importance of the casting of a rock star like David Bowie in that character, because that's when we kind of start, you know, crushing after somebody. It's after an actor or a musician or a big fat rock star like David Bowie. I was about Jennifer Connelly's age when I first watched Labyrinth. So I was going through the whole high school thing, getting crushes on boys. So this was the perfect movie to watch at that time, I'm sure. Someone should tell Jareth that jeggings aren't pants.
Ugh, not pants.
You know what else is not something? The lyrics to Dance, Magic Dance do not make any sense. But
none
I
of the lyrics to any of the songs make any sense.
Can we just take a moment and imagine David Bowie? Because in the behind the scenes, like, making of Labyrinth, little, like, featurette on the movie, he sits there and talks very honestly and deeply about how, you know, moving this music is.
You remind me of the babe with the power. Power of voodoo.
Voodoo.
Remind me of the babe.
I saw my babe. Crying for this babe. Could cry. What could I do?
Sudden it's just a little too romantic because he's not really talking about a baby anymore. It transforms to kind of like a bebe, and then all of a sudden we're back to magic again. This makes no sense, and that is why it is amazing. And then his like choreography with his like pimp cane in that part, I can't.
Apparently there was no choreography for that scene. And they just, like, told everyone in the room, be a goblin.
I love that scene when he throws that baby in the air and it goes so high and it's clearly a doll. Clearly.
I have this problem. When movies I first saw when I was really young, when, like, the special effects are amazing, it always shocks and upsets me when I watch it again as an adult. And obviously terrible. Like, the scene with the fire gang.
Oh my gosh, that's so, another song that makes sense.
The Fieries, I mean, so obviously, it wasn't green screening, so black screening. I didn't notice that when I was 10.
I have to say that, I mean, you do notice it now, but I love how those puppets work.
Yes.
I mean, those are incredible. They're not suits, but they're attached to them so that they can sort of move them around and... Oh, it's so cool. I mean, it's just really cool. And then, I mean, let's just talk about the lyrics.
Thanks for the fire.
It's so out of nowhere, which is totally fine.
It's totally on crack.
And then that's also terrifying when they're like, oh, you're not supposed to throw other people's heads. You only throw your own head. We'll throw your head. And then I'm like, oh my God, run.
Which is what she did.
Run, those run. Puppets are everything I love about the Jim Henson Company. It could take 5 people to operate one of the Fieries.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't really seen, at least in popular puppetry, before Jim Henson. These people would just decide they want to do something, and since no one told them that it was impossible, they'd just figure out how to do it. They had 4 people working on Hoggle. Right. They had video cameras inside of costumes so people could see where they were going.
The Hoggle mask is just ridiculous. Like, all of what it takes to animate all the eyebrows and everything, that's the best blend of special effect and live action type things, I think, in the movie, is that as a kid, and even now watching it, he's just a character. I'm not like, oh, I can see the motor moving his eyebrow.
Yeah, Hoggle, they said, was the most complicated puppet they'd ever built, at least up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a person inside the suit doing all the body movement and 4 puppeteers controlling 18 motors inside the face rig.
One of whom was Brian Henson, mm-hmm. Jim Henson's son.
My other puppet that I love that's a little bit of a puppet, even though maybe not, is the juggler who does the glass dream balls.
That sounds juggling, so dirty.
Thank you. Contact juggling, much better way of putting that than dream balls. Thank you. David Bowie and his dream balls. Oh, God.
The contact juggler's name is Michael Motion, and he is huge in the juggling community. There's no green screening. There are no special effects with this. At times, he was leaning behind David Bowie, replacing his arm and reaching up so it could be in the shot. I think it sometimes they said he was crouched between his legs, reaching his arms up, and performing these intricate contact juggling moves completely blind.
It's just such a cool effect. And even now watching the movie, you can't tell that it's someone else in any way.
And what I love about watching that behind-the-scenes stuff is that David Bowie thinks it's so funny when it messes up, and he's, like, laughing, and the contact juggler behind him is, like, cursing, and he's like, oh, I hate this.
Oh, you know what we forgot to talk about?
What?
Helping hands that
are
terrifying.
That's my favorite scene. I guess it's really 2 scenes. The logic puzzle into the helping hands.
Mm-hmm.
I love the logic puzzle so much. I think because it's one of the first times I encountered something like that.
Well, the only way out of here is to try one of these doors. One of them leads to the castle at the center of the labyrinth, and the other one leads to...
Bum-bum-bum-bum.
Certain death.
Ooh.
Which one is which?
We can't tell you.
Why not?
We don't know.
But they do.
Oh, then I'll ask them.
No, you can't ask us. You can only ask one of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the rules. And I should warn you that one of us always tells the truth and one of us always lies. That's a rule, too. He always lies.
I do not. I tell the truth.
Oh, what a lie.
Oh. He's the liar.
All right. Answer yes or no. Would he tell me that this door leads to the castle?
Yes?
Then the other door leads to the castle, and this door leads to certain death.
Oh. How do you know? He could be telling the truth.
But then you wouldn't be. So if you told me that he said yes, I know the answer is no.
But I could be telling the truth.
But then he would be lying. So if you told me that he said yes, I know the answer would still be no.
Wait a minute. Is that right? I don't know. I've never understood it.
I am positive I watched this movie really young, and I know I spent a good deal of time trying to figure out how she came to the conclusion she comes to. But then the helping hand scene, it's so amazing and so creative.
That is one of the most creative uses of storytelling that I've ever seen.
Again, with so many people working together to create one character, when the hands come together to make the faces that speak to her.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Hey,
What do you mean, help?
We are helping.
We are helping hands.
You're hurting.
Would you like us to let go?
No!
Well then, come on. Which way?
Which way?
Up or down?
Oh.
Come on, come on.
We haven't got all day.
Well, it's a big decision for her.
Which way do you want to go?
Yes, which way?
I really like the As the World Falls Down scene where she gets sucked into the dream orb, we shall say. And then I love the scene at the end where she's challenging him. I just think they're so well written in those two scenes. So well placed. And as a kid, I didn't really understand it, but as an adult, I enjoy those scenes more because I really think they're about what is at the heart of the film. The design is just really cool. With who does those paintings with all the stairs that go?
That's Escher.
And so I love the whole, you know, everything I've done, I did for you. Again, that's another thing that's really creative and bringing something that we all know. I mean, you know, it's used in this new way, and that's what I appreciate about most of the movie. But those two films, I like how they take the princess thing and make it a very adult moment, and then they take that poster and sort of break it apart and have all that really great scene at the end between them. Those are my favorites.
I totally agree with, and I love As the World Falls Down and With You and You, but kind of for different reasons, because growing up and actually, still to this day, I'm a huge fan of the stage version of Phantom of the Opera. That's what As the World Falls Down and Within You are to me. It's this mysterious man having an obsessive relationship with this young girl, and she's also very fascinated by him, and I love it. And it also features some of Bowie's best acting, because he is kind of grandiose throughout the entire thing, and then during the songs, he's so subtle.
So I have a question for you guys, and this is a question that came from one of our audio comments. Did Jareth ever actually love Sarah?
I thought about it a little bit. At the very beginning, he is very antagonizing towards her. But I also think back to the Beauty and the Beast love stories, the Phantom of the Opera love stories. And I'm not saying it's a healthy love, but I think he does love her in this weird, obsessive, romantic kind of way.
I do think that he loves her. I don't think he knows how to express it in a way that is acceptable by humans everywhere on planet Earth. But I do think that he loves her. I think that he's just the Goblin King, and the Goblin King goes about it in the wrong way.
Yeah.
I think that if he does actually truly love her, that it isn't from the start of the movie. I think it occurs as she's fighting her way through the labyrinth.
Totally agree.
But can we just talk about Turn Back, Sarah?
Turn back, Sarah. Turn back before it's too late.
I can't. Don't you understand that I can't?
What a pity.
I honestly think that they did that line over and over again, and David Bowie just decided to joke around with that one, and that's the one Jim Henson chose out of spite.
I love that everything he says is kind of said very lightly, you know, and his whole villain shtick, that whatever he says before, he's like, well, laugh, and then all the goblins, like, laugh. You know, that's just, like, so uber-villain to me. And,
it's kind of like the Joker.
Exactly, and yeah. And I love that when it finally gets to the end and he's, like, fighting for his life, I just think that that's such an interesting dichotomy between his two halves. There's, like, the Goblin King dance, magic dance, playful, turn back, Sarah half, and then there's this other very desperate person inside of him.
It's a very dark side of him.
And he plays it so well. I'm sorry, it's David Bowie, but he acts the business out of this role.
He's actually a pretty good actor, especially in The Prestige. He actually knows what he's doing, which is weird.
So awesome.
So who are your favorite characters in here? And if you say Jareth, you have to pick another one too.
Well, I was going to say Jareth, but I guess I'll pick another one too because I have to. I really love Sir Didymus and his dog.
Ambrosius!
Ambrosius. I just love when he's like... I have sworn a blood oath.
Wait a minute. You forget my sacred vow, my lady. I cannot let you pass.
But you just said Ludo is your brother.
I have taken an oath and I must defend it to the death.
What's
okay, let's handle this thing logically. What exactly have you sworn?
I have sworn with my life blood. No one shall pass this way without my permission.
Well, may we have your permission?
Well, I... Yes?
I just think that's so Monty Python.
He's totally my favorite character, too, for exactly the same reason, that he's such a Python character, that there is so much of Terry Jones in him. Monty Python's Terry Jones wrote the screenplay, and I think at some places it's more obvious than others, and it is fully obvious in Sir Didymus, and that's why I love him so much.
I really like him, and even though it's very short, I love the guy who sits on top of the other dude's head, and he's like, it's so stimulating being your head.
You want to get to the castle, huh?
How's that for brain power, huh?
Be quiet!
Nuts.
So, young woman, the way forward is sometimes the way back.
Will you listen to this crap?
Will you please be quiet?
All right.
Okay?
Okay.
All right.
All right.
What?
Sorry.
Finished?
Yes.
It's such a small moment, but I just love that that character is so clearly drawn out.
Let's see. Of course I love Jareth, but of the main characters, I definitely love Ludo. Because he doesn't say a lot of words, and he's just this big lumbering creature, but you just come to love him.
Friend?
That's right, Ludo. I'm Sarah.
Sarah.
Oh, here, let me help you. You okay?
Sarah. Sarah, friend.
And he has a superpower, too. He can call rocks. And
what is that about?
I love how when they're running through the Goblin City, out of nowhere, Sarah goes, Ludo, call the rocks! And I'm like, what? You wouldn't know.
And one of the little minor characters I really love is the blue worm at the very beginning.
I love the worm.
He saves the movie and gives it a plot. He says, don't go that way.
Things are not always what they seem in this place. So you can't take anything for granted.
Hey!
Hey, hang on!
Thank you. That was incredibly helpful.
But don't go that way.
What was that?
I said, don't go that way. Never go that way.
Oh, thanks.
If she'd have kept on going down that way, she'd have gone straight to that castle.
Apparently it was once in the rumor mill that Tim Burton wanted to do a Labyrinth remake.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah,
I'm certainly know that it would be ruined, but if I could be a part of it, I'd at least have fun. Maybe I could be Jared.
No, that would be Johnny Depp.
He would be a great Jared, except that he can't sing.
So does that mean that Helena Bonham Carter would be Sarah?
Ew.
No, I think she would be the junkyard lady.
Yes, she would be a great junkyard lady.
She looks like the junkyard lady.
He totally didn't discuss and is one of the most terrifying parts of the movie besides Goblins Under the Bed.
It is one of the first incarnations of Hoarders, the TV show.
But it's so deep.
That's actually a really, I hesitate to say moving scene, but it is sort of moving to me that that's where it really starts to touch on that clinging to these childhood things is so not right. Like, there's something very unnatural about it.
Oh, you're a little bunny rabbit. You like your little bunny rabbit, don't you? Yes, yes, yes. There you go. Ooh, there's Betsy Boo. You remember Betsy Boo, don't you? Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Now then, what else have we got? What's this? Ooh, let's have a look. Oh, it's a pencil box. Got lots of pencils in it, too. And, oh, Here's your panda slippers. You know how much you like your panda slippers. You never wanted them thrown away, did you? There they are. That's right, that's right. Okay, now then, what else? Oh, it's little horsey. You love little horsey, don't you, dear? And look at this. You got a printing game, you have. Oh, here's a treasure. You'll want that, won't you, my dear? Yes, go on. Put it on. Make yourself up. And here's dear old Flopsy. You'll want her, right? There you go. Oh, yes. Ah, oh, yes. Charlie Bear. Right, there's Charlie Bear for you.
Huh? It was something I was looking for.
Don't talk nonsense. It's all here. Everything in the world you've ever cared about is all right here. Look.
I also just love the puppet's character design, where it's this small woman and she's carrying this huge pack of things that's just towering over her, and she's just carrying it around everywhere she goes. I just love it. And she's purple and gray.
And she starts to create a pack for Sarah when she's not paying attention. And that's how it happens.
Yeah,
exactly. When you're not paying attention.
I love it. And, yes, the publishing house Tokyo Pop, a couple years back, released over the course of several years, 4 volumes of a sequel to Jim Henson's Labyrinth called Return to the Labyrinth. And it focuses on Jareth and Toby. And our good friend Sarah did a nice little review of it that we are going to play right now.
Hi, it's Sarah here with a 5-minute review on Return to Labyrinth. I will try to keep it spoiler-free, as it's an awesome manga series that you definitely don't want spoiled for you. So, Return to Labyrinth was a 4-volume series that went from 2006 to 2010. The last one came out August 2010, so not even really a year ago. Basically, a really, really gorgeous collection of manga. It's very well drawn. Once or twice, you're kind of like, they could have done better on that. But for the most part, gorgeously drawn, especially the covers by Chris Lai, who did an amazing job. Hope I'm saying your name right. That you just, when you see those covers, you just wanna grab them up and read them. They're amazing covers. Like, don't judge a book by its cover, but these ones might be safe too. So the storyline is that it's 13 years after the events of Labyrinth the movie take place. Toby is growing up and basically spends all his time playing, forget what the generic Warcraft type name it was, the game he's obsessed with, but basically he's taken over the role of Sarah from the first Labyrinth, kind of always dreaming, has his head, you know, where it shouldn't be. And funnily enough, they keep most of the characters the same, but the mom? Like, did any of you get from the movie that she really was a jerk? Because I kind of thought that in the movie it was kind of like Sarah was kind of spoiled in the beginning, and so she was seeing her stepmom as always being a jerk. Well, yeah, they changed that in the manga. She's like the biggest, meanest jerk ever. Like, seriously, the note on the refrigerator, I can't remember what it says, but it's something like, if you must eat, then there's this and this in the fridge. It's like, they totally turned her into the biggest jerk ever. Anyway, Jareth is basically stalking Toby, and since, I'm pretty sure, a ripoff of Dobby, whose name is Scoob, a goblin. Not to say that I don't like him, but he's totally a ripoff of Dobby from Harry Potter. Sends him to basically trick Toby into wandering into Labyrinth, and basically more tricks happen to make Toby the king, the goblin king of Labyrinth. Basically, can't say too much else about the storyline except for Jareth makes an appearance in our world to trick Sarah into, who is a very different Sarah also. She's kind of a shadow of who she was in the movie. She's a school teacher and she's kind of lost her creative dreaming side and is very much more grounded and has her, you know, feet on the floor or whatever they call that thing than she was in the movie. That's one of the intertwining plot lines, Jareth and Sarah, and also Toby and all the things that are happening to him in Labyrinth. There are some interesting new characters. Hannah the pixie, who's kind of a goth pixie, don't really care for, but her little steed, Stank, who is basically a mini Ludo, who Ludo is one of my favorite characters, so how can I not like Stank? is adorable, and I want a stuffed animal with him. And the antagonist, Mizumi, the Queen of Moraine, and her two daughters, Drumlin and Mulin, very interesting additives. It's interesting we get to see a lot more of the architecture and the inside of the Goblin City, so it's very interesting for that. We get to see, like, kind of how they live, their culture, which is pretty cool, actually. The thing with Mizumi, Drumlin, and Mulin is they fit, kind of, but it almost feels like Japanese legend or something that is interposed with, you know, more Western storytelling. It's kind of jarring a bit, but it works if you really think about it, but at first it's a little strange, a little confusing, because it's hard to explain, but it's just not something you're necessarily used to, unless, of course, if you read manga all the time, and then you probably wouldn't even notice it. But anyway, great new characters, definitely worthwhile series. I love the ending. It was very, very satisfying, and I read it like two or three times because I liked it so much. All in all, a really amazing series. Sorry I can't tell you more about it, but I really don't want to spoil it for you guys. If you love Labyrinth, you really should check it out. It's worthwhile. Has lots of in-jokes that you will get if you're a Labyrinth fan. You probably won't get and think people are totally insane if you haven't watched Labyrinth. But then again, if you haven't watched Labyrinth, then I'd really doubt you'd be reading this comic to begin with. Anyway, I definitely recommend it, and thanks.
Yay, thank you, Sarah.
We love you, Sarah.
Yay, Sarah.
Yay,
turn
Sarah.
Back, Sarah, before it's too late.
Turn back, Sarah.
So we have some audio comments. Yay.
Yay.
That will play.
Hello, ladies. Daniel here, Dangelus on your lovely forums, and today I've got my wife with me.
Hi.
And the reason I've got my wife with me is because you're doing a show on Labyrinth, and I have no clue about this film. I've seen it once. I was pretty much forced to watch it by my wife.
I've been forced to watch many a film by you, yeah. To be fair.
Fair enough, yeah. not that I dislike the film, I just don't know a lot about it, but my wife, Laura, is quite, maybe not an expert, but she does love the film, so I thought we'd get together and record your little segment. So, Laura, what do you like about the film, and why?
I love the story of the film. I think it's a lovely story about a girl who struggles with her family and with looking after her brother, but then once he's taken away, she realises actually how much she loves him, and she fights very hard to rescue him. I love David Bowie.
In that film, or particularly, or in general?
In that film, in his tight trousers, he looks very good.
oh dear. This is, I think in the States they call it a G-rated. So, let's not go there. Okay. What about, what elements of the film though? Because obviously it is a fantasy film. Mm. And knowing you, you're not really big on that sort of stuff. You're not really a geek like me in terms of stuff like that. So does it interest you at all? Or is it something, do you not even notice it? Is the story that good that you don't even notice sort of the fantasy element?
I think I probably don't notice it now. I mean, I've loved this film since I was a child. When I was a little kiddywink, me and my brother used to watch it. We used to alternate every other day between Labyrinth and Neverending Story. We absolutely loved those films. And I just think that's what you do as a child. You watch films over and over again. I mean, it has translated into my adult life. I don't watch it, very regularly, but I still love it. The one thing I do very regularly is listen to the soundtrack. I still absolutely love that. I think it's Bowie's best work.
Well, I don't know about that, but
it is. It's better than Ziggy.
Is it? Okay. So, but obviously, you got into the soundtrack from knowing the film.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Any particular characters in the film that you like or you relate to or anything like that?
No, I don't think I relate to any of the characters. I do like Jared.
Who's that?
Are you picking up a big Bowie thing?
Bowie.
He's David Bowie.
Okay.
I wouldn't say I relate to any of the characters. I've never been in any of the situations they've been in.
Well, I wouldn't hope not, since it is sort of set in another world. What about any particular scenes or, you know, part of the story elements that you like? Or?
I think my favourite scene when I was a little girl would probably have been when Hoggle gave Sarah the peach. I think it was a peach. He gave her a peach and it sort of transported her into a ballroom,
right,
where she was dancing with David Bowie. And
I think I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, she looked so beautiful. She looked just like a princess, and I guess that probably, you know, when you're a kid, that's, you know, what you look up to and what you aspire to achieve, and I never have. But
some do.
But it was just a beautiful scene. One thing that maybe, girls, you could answer on the podcast, I've never understood. Did Jared actually love Sarah? I never understood that. Did he love her?
That's a good question. I don't know.
because I don't know why he did what he did, really. I don't know what his motivation was.
Okie dokie. That's a good question. Maybe they can answer that for us. Okay, what's your favourite song, then, to end on?
I love Underground. Okay. I think it's an amazing song. If anyone's never listened to the full version of it, you should do, because it's absolutely amazing.
Is that on the soundtrack?
It is.
Okay. I'm sure a lot of the listeners have probably got that. Okay. Well, that'll probably do. We're rambling on now, so we'll just say we're looking forward to listening to the podcast and all your thoughts, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.
I certainly will be listening. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, Sue. Hello, Casey. This is Meds from various podcasts like Waffle On Podcast and Mash 4077. Of course, I'm one of the writers of Martian Creative, and it's brilliant that you're doing a podcast on the film Labyrinth. It was one of my favourite films from the mid-80s, but probably not the reason why a lot of other people are. I'm a huge Monty Python fan. And the reason why I like Labyrinth so much is because the screenplay is by Monty Python star Terry Jones. You can tell it's wrote by Jones because he has this a beautiful way of bringing surrealism and mixing it with a slight childlike quality, which he does so well. His books are always like that, especially his children's books. If you get the chance to read any of them, you can see there's a bit of Labyrinth in all of them. And that's what I really like about this. That, and of course, it's a Jim Henson film. It's one of the last films he actually took part in, obviously. He sadly passed away, which is a great loss for filmmaking. And it's produced by George Lucas. Meh, is my feelings towards George Lucas. But, you know, credit where credit due. It's a brave thing for him to produce. It didn't make much money at the box office. I believe its gross revenue was only $12 million and it had a budget of $25 million. But like everything, you know, it's become a cult classic, and rightly so. So was the Blues Brothers. Look what happened to that. It's got a strange cast. Jennifer Connelly, who I later became a great fan of, and David Bowie. Oh, that man's weird. He does look like a Muppet, actually, especially in this. You're probably mistaken him for one of the big hairy monsters. But it's a great film. I haven't seen it in, must be about 15 to 20 years. So I'm really looking forward to hearing you both talk about this. and I can't wait to hear it. It's a great story. It reminds me, it came out around about the time as The Dark Crystal. You know, and I remember going to see both of these films at the cinema and coming out just totally in love with them. I really must go out. I don't own it on DVD either, so I think after listening to you two talk about this film, I'm going to end up going out and buying it. Anyway, keep up the good work, and I can't wait to hear the podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, Casey and Sue, this is Kenny from California. I'm also the host of Knights of the Guild podcast, the MASH 4077 podcast, and a brand new one I just started called Confessions of a Fanboy. I just wanted to send in some quick comments about one of my all-time favorite fantasy movies, Labyrinth. Now, I know these comments are coming in late, and you're just going to drop them into the show and won't be responding to them, so hopefully I won't repeat anything that your listeners have already heard on the podcast. But I'm so happy that you guys are doing a podcast on Labyrinth. Like I said, it is one of my all-time favorite, my top five favorite fantasies. And I remember seeing this. I was 15, 16 years old when this came out, and I just totally fell in love with this world. I've always been a huge fantasy fan. It was just a fantastic, creative, you know, imaginative world. You had Jim Henson directing, George Lucas was producing. You had the great talents of David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. I mean, you couldn't go wrong. And one little side note, which I thought was really, really cool, is that our wonderful Dr. Crusher from Star Trek The Next Generation actually worked on this movie. She was the choreographer, and she also did some puppet movement. What's interesting is that when she acts, she goes by Gates McFadden, but when she is a choreographer, she goes by Cheryl McFadden, which Cheryl's her real first name. And so she worked on this movie way before she even, you know, got the role as Dr. Crusher. So that's just a little sci-fi geek trivia there. Yeah, it's just a fun movie. I love the soundtrack. I love the music. Everything about this, the acting, the puppetry, the costumes, just the world itself is just fantastic. And it's very, very cool that you're doing this podcast. And I can't wait to listen to it. And I hope you guys have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
I love that Dan brought in his wife to talk about it, because I love having those two different opinions. It really does seem like girls like this movie more than dudes. And I also want to address Meds' comment about Terry Jones. Terry Jones wrote the original screenplay, but he says, for the most part, it's not really his movie anymore. It's not really his script, because after The Peach, it's totally different.
Yeah, a lot of it got changed.
Yeah, he had to do a lot of rewrites, and I kind of read the original screenplay, and I like bits of it, and it definitely has a better flow, but I definitely like how it played out by the very end.
So we also got another comment in the form of email. It was quick email from Lee, and it said, well, as a real quick bit of feedback, here's a picky of my doggy. We named him Ludo. Say no more. Aww. Labyrinth rules.
And he looks like a much cuter version of Ludo. It's so cute.
And we have permission to share that picture in our show notes. So that will be up there for everyone to see the puppy Ludo.
Puppy Ludo, yeah. Fred.
I can't let this episode end without mentioning that Gates McFadden was the choreographer and director of puppet movement. Gates McFadden, Dr. Beverly Crusher. And if you do watch Inside the Labyrinth, watch it all the way till the end, because you see amazing early 80s Gates McFadden. Amazing.
It is awesome. Oh, I also want to mention the unsung hero of this project, Brian Froud, who is the fantasy artist who basically designed all of the goblins. This fantasy artist and Jim Henson were just like, oh, we just finished Dark Crystal. What do you want to do next? I kind of want to do something about goblins. And then he went through this entire sketchbook drawing goblins, and then he drew a baby in the midst of all these goblins, and Jim Henson went, that's what I want the film to be about.
Yeah.
This and the Dark Crystal, it's very interesting. Like, there is a similar kind of, like, gritty, not gritty as in dark, but, like, a tangible aspect of both of those fantasy movies, which is not so much the case anymore with films, because so much is CGI. Mm-hmm. And I loved how that world is so real, and it's a little cartoony as well. You know, it's just such its own style. I don't think people have an edit button as much, because they can accomplish whatever they can't actually make with these, like, I win buttons with CGI. And it sort of takes away, I love the edit button, because it makes you very creative, like with the helping hands and things like that. And having to actually have it there, you know, it makes a huge difference in just the overall look and scale of the production.
I think I've told this to Sue before, but you have a lot more chemistry with the puppet than you do with the tennis ball.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they would have more puppetry in film. I think it's not used at all anymore because they think they can go more realistic with computer animation. And while it is beautiful, you need that connection with something. Something.
Yeah, something that is alive in some way.
Yeah.
I see puppets as having such a larger place in film than CGI. And this isn't meant, you know, to be offensive to anyone. CGI, it is art, but it's a different kind of art than performance.
Absolutely. And when you and have there's nothing wrong with it, you
right.
know.
No. A puppet is still being performed. But when you're creating computer animation, you know, you have to get it right. And there's no such thing as a completely right performance. It's just what it is. And it's so much more organic than react to this tennis ball.
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah.
And really, the only special effects, there's a lot of forced perspective in Labyrinth, and there's that green screening. But the only CGI is the owl in the beginning. Everything else was made and created. And I think you have to be a lot more creative when you're not using CGI.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
I totally agree.
Well, we agree. So watch out, world, because we agree.
It's kind of like Kids in the Hall. 30 Helens agree.
So funny.
So the next thing up in the Anomaly feed will be Anomaly's coverage of Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. And then after that will be Sarah's review of her first time through Babylon 5. So if you have comments to send for any of those podcasts, send them on in. And that should about wrap it up. I'm Sue.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Anne.
And you have been listening to Anomaly Supplemental.
But I'd rather indulge my many passions, even if my squaritude's a little too pronounced. Perhaps I
if you wish to contact the Anomaly Supplemental, you can at the email address, which is moregirlygeeks@gmail.com. That's girlygeeks with a Z at gmail.com. Or if you like hearing the sound of your own voice, like I do, you can call the voicemail line at 248-419-GEEK. Yes, it's one of those numbers that you can use alphabets on, and that's 248-419-4335. To stay up to date with Anomaly and Anomaly Supplemental News, you can follow them on Twitter at Anomaly Podcast. That's the at symbol, A-N-O-M-A-L-Y Podcast. That's all one word. Check out the Anomaly blog for geeky articles and Anomaly Supplemental show notes. Find it online at anomalypodcast.com. To meet other anomalies, please join the Anomaly forums. Click on the forum icon at anomalypodcast.com. The theme music is used by permission of Marion Call. Thank you, Marion. Find out more at marioncall.com. Or, of course, you can follow her on Twitter at Marion Call. That's MarianCall. Anomaly was created under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 Unported License. Oh, say that three times fast.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.
So I won't ever once be bored. Oh,
I have been a nerd since long before anyone heard that fair and scrawny was the latest fashion trend. And I still be a geek after nobody thinks it's chic, because I don't require approval.
Yo mama's so fat, her Patronus is a cake.